From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's Monday, April 18th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. Today, Syrians demonstrate for freedom and women are among the protesters in Yemen.
Before this revolution, women can't go outside after 7:30 p.m. or 8. Now they sleep here.
Also ahead, go on, fail.
People do not feel that freedom to experiment, that more or less the freedom that we have as children. When children fail, we say, okay, you learn something. And somehow we lose that tolerance when people grow up.
The Institute of Brilliant Failures, coming up.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Syrians are demanding an end to the authoritarian rule of President Bashar Assad. Yesterday, clashes between security forces and demonstrators in the city of Homs left several people dead. Today, thousands attended the funerals of some of the victims. The mourners called for freedom and demanded the release of all political prisoners. Walid Safour is the president of the Syrian Human Rights Committee, which is based in London. He says yesterday's protests in Homs began peacefully.
No people made any sign of violence, but the Syrian securities opened fire straight away. That's what happened, and now we count until this morning 24 fatal casualties.
You say that there is no violence on the part of the protesters. Here's what we're hearing from Syrian officials, and we tried to get a comment from officials there. They have not returned our calls, but Syria's foreign minister was quoted by the state-run news agency as telling foreign ambassadors, reforms are a national need, but they cannot be forced through violence, weapons, sabotage, and road closures. Is there not any kind of armed revolt among the protesters, weaponry, attempts at violence?
From the start of these protests 4 years ago, the Syrian official media and the official Syrian people say these troubled started and initiated by sometimes Palestinians, sometimes by extremists, and sometimes by people crossing the borders. But actually, it's perpetrated by the Syrian security forces and the thugs related to them. This is what happened. In Homs, all people I have contacted, they assured me that they were among the either the funeral mourning their dead, or they were protesting somewhere else peacefully, and then live ammunition shot at them. Even the injured were not allowed to go to hospitals, and this is against international covenants and agreements. I know that at least two hospitals appealed for blood because of loss of blood among the casualties and the injured. However, some people hurried to give blood, and when they came to the hospitals, they were arrested by security elements.
Yeah, for what reason were they arrested?
They don't want them to give blood. They don't want to save lives. This is what happened in Syria. We are under emergency law for 5 decades.
This is all very hard to confirm on the ground in Syria because foreign journalists are not allowed there officially. Let me ask you this. When you talk about the state of emergency that's been imposed for 50 years now, what has that meant for the people of Syria? And would the lifting of it satisfy these protesters?
What satisfies the protesters is the lifting of the emergency laws, the confining of security forces to their barracks, not to be involved in the life of the normal citizens. In Syria, there is no rule of the law at all. The upper hand is for the security forces, which detain and arrest everybody. We want a democratic rule, multi-party system. This is what the Syrian people ask.
Mr. Safour, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Waleed Zafour is the president of the Syrian Human Rights Committee, which is based in London. He spoke with us about the Syrian government's crackdown on recent protests. The so-called Arab Spring has also arrived in Yemen. More than 100 people have died in 2 months of protests in the country. The demonstrators are calling for the president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, to step down. They count among their allies a number of defectors from Saleh's ruling party, including several women. In fact, the BBC's Natalia Antalava found during her month-long trip to Yemen that women are playing a significant role in the movement. Natalia is now at the BBC studios in Washington. You have met a number of female protesters in Yemen. I wonder how their actions and their protests have changed life for other women in the country.
You know, the extraordinary thing is that I went to Yemen for the first time in early February when the protests were just beginning. And everybody predicted that they would fail. And one of the main reasons why people were so skeptical is because everyone said that there was no chance that Yemenis would be able to mobilize half of their population, that there was no way that women would take to the streets. And coming back now and spending a month there, one of the most astonishing things was seeing tens of thousands of women out in the streets every day, being very outspoken, up on stages, telling men what to do. I mean, all these things that seemed absolutely inconceivable before. And in fact, one of the leaders of Yemen's uprising is a woman, and she was literally one of three women that were involved in the beginning when it was all starting. Now she's become a household name, very much of a hero of this revolution in the making. And her name is Tawakkul Kamal, and here's what she told me.
I was the only one with three of my friends when we start our revolution. Now, I couldn't imagine that all these women, they are here and they are singing the slogans of the revolution, and all the men listen to them and repeat. Before this revolution, women can't go outside after 7:30 p.m. or 8. Now they sleep here.
It's surprising that she, and even to you, that she's being welcomed by men as she is, but we can't say that's across the board. There are a lot of people who resent what she's doing.
Well, I think, what a lot of women are saying is that it's not really amazing that we found strength to come out and protest. We knew that we had it. What's amazing is the fact that men are welcoming it. But there is no question that a lot of men don't approve. And very interestingly, the last speech that President Ali Abdullah Saleh gave to his mostly male supporters in Sana'a that I went to, he mentioned the issue and he actually shamed the opposition for using women. And he said that it was very un-Islamic what they were doing, and mixing men and women was very un-Islamic. And that obviously infuriated all the women out in the Change Square of Sana'a, and they've been staging more marches ever since. What's very ironic about his comment is the fact that they're very much of a driving force behind the masses of these women. While there are a lot of individual stories and individual women who are not affiliated with any party, but the driving force of these women is Yemen's opposition Islamist party, ISLAH. But at the same time, I think attitudes do die very hard. And I spoke while in Yemen to one of the most influential men in Yemen, whose name is Hamid al-Ahmar, and he's a member of ISLAH, and I asked him what he thought about women's political participation.
We realized that the world had changed, and now the ISLAHI ladies in the streets has the biggest number of ladies in the streets. So we don't have a problem in ISLAH about ladies. And we like ladies more than the others, and this is why we get two or three wives.
Yeah, a joke from Hamid al-Ahmar, but I'm sure it's a joke that wouldn't go down very well with campaigners for women's rights. There is no question that attitudes die hard. And there is, I think, also no question that this revolution isn't about women. It's not about their rights. But what's very clear is that it has changed things massively already, because simply 2 months ago, you could simply not imagine so many women getting up on stage and telling men what they think.
All right. Thank you very much. The BBC's Natalia Antalava, thank you again.
Thanks very much.
Now, the revolution in Egypt, it not only toppled President Hosni Mubarak, it led to the dissolution of Mubarak's party and the turning over of all its assets to the state. This is welcome news to the dozens of new political parties that are emerging in Cairo, as Ursula Lindsay reports.
Protesters already burnt the headquarters of President Mubarak's party to the ground in January. Now that the party is officially dissolved, many here are celebrating what they hope will be a new era of democratic competition. Under Mubarak, a government committee reviewed applications of anyone wanting to start a political party, and it denied most of them. That was the case of the Wasat Party, explained spokesman Yamin Nuh.
We were trying for about 15 years, trying to have the license to participate in the political life as a formal party.
Wasat, or the Middle Way Party, is a moderate offshoot of the Islamist opposition group, the Muslim Brotherhood. It's open to Christians as well as Muslims. The Wasat Party was fighting for recognition in court when the revolution broke out. Days after Mubarak stepped down, a judge ruled in its favor. And last month, the current military authorities passed a law making it pretty easy for any group to form a party. The Muslim Brotherhood has announced it will do so. So have dozens of others. They're all looking to participate in the parliamentary and presidential elections scheduled for this year. Nuh says the more parties, the better.
It's a very good thing that we have many parties, and we start practicing after 30 years of stuck in that past regime of Hosni Mubarak. We have political virginity. I can explain it like that.
Nuh is referring to the fact that for decades the Mubarak regime stage-managed politics, never allowing parties to really build a following. As I interview Nuh, two would-be members drop by Wasat's offices and sit with one of his colleagues. Mohammed Osman is a middle-aged engineer. Osman says he's part of the silent majority, who never joined a political party before because they didn't see the use. He says now he wants to find a way to make his voice heard. The time of sitting at home and expressing our anger on the internet is over, he says. We need to get out. Lots of other parties are planning their strategies as well. The Egyptian Social Democratic Party's Youth Committee meets in a bookstore in downtown Cairo. Theirs is one of several new liberal parties. The group discusses organizing activities in universities and putting up flyers in low-income neighborhoods. Everyone, it seems, has come to the conclusion that they should be doing something. Some have decided that forming a political party isn't their best option, but creating a political action committee is. Hundreds of young people are packed into a large auditorium in Cairo. The revolution will not be over, the speaker says, until all the old regime's cronies are brought to justice. The event is organized by the April 6 movement. The movement was one of the forces behind the fall of President Mubarak. Amr Ali is one of the young founding members.
We would have never been allowed to have a conference like this. There would have been intelligence officers at the door. People were afraid to approach us. Today, no one is afraid.
In the lobby, volunteers gather the contact information of eager new members. Amal Sharaf, another founder, says April 6 believes it can work for change best by not being a political party.
When we founded the movement, we decided that we will not seek authority.
In fact, the purpose of this new political action group is to lobby for a law that would allow the creation of new PACs. It's a novel idea here. At the conference, a flyer is circulated that cites the pro-democratic advocacy group MoveOn.org and the pro-Israel lobby group APAC as examples April 6 would like to emulate. The earnest conversation, one of hundreds, if not thousands, taking place every day across the country, goes on. Talk of politics in Egypt used to be full of jokes and cynicism. Now that something might really be at stake, the tone has changed. For The World, I'm Ursula Lindsay in Cairo.
You can explore all of the world's reporting on Egypt. We've got slideshows, a timeline that goes from the start of the revolution to the present day, and also a live conversation on Twitter. That's all at theworld.org/Egypt. Still ahead on The World, our geo-quiz, our global hit at the end of the program, and failure is the new success on PRI. That's Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Jeffrey Mutai won the 115th Boston Marathon today in world record time. Jeffrey Mutai is from Kenya, no surprise. Kenyans have now won 18 of the past 21 Boston Marathons. Runners from the East African country have dominated the sport, and not only in Boston. And that doesn't sit too well with organizers of the Utrecht Marathon in the Netherlands. They've come up with a way to give the hometown racers a leg up over the Kenyans. Theo Thomas is a sports correspondent with Radio Netherlands Worldwide. He is now in Amsterdam. So what are they doing over there to discourage Kenyans from competing?
Well, first of all, they're not inviting them, which means that they can't compete for prize money. Not the big cash prizes, by the way. They can compete for a dismal $143, but not for the main prize money of $14,300.
But they can compete for $143. I'm not even sure that's going to pay for the cab fare to the start of the race site. But is it just Kenyans they're trying to keep from competing?
Well, mainly Kenyans, yes, because they've won, like you said in your intro, most of the events so far. In the past 5 years, there are five major marathons here in Holland. They've won 23 out of the past 25. There was one Belgian who won it, one Ethiopian, but the rest were Kenyans, yes.
But the lower take for the winners would be just for Kenyans or for anybody who's not Dutch?
Anyone who's not Dutch, because otherwise I think the organisers would say it's discriminating the Kenyans. So the non-Dutch athletes have not been invited, so only Dutch athletes can go for the big money.
But this is interpreted a certain way. I mean, as you say, the organisers are saying, no, this is not discriminatory, it's not just against Kenyans, but the interpretation by the public there is quite different, isn't it?
Oh, definitely, yes. In Holland too. I mean, mainly in Kenya, where this measure has caused quite an outcry. People say, well, it's discrimination, because they say the Dutch have won our golf tournaments and the prize money has been much higher. What if we were to ban Dutch players from taking part in our golf tournaments? That would amount to the same thing. That would cause an outcry in Holland too. So they say it doesn't do anything to encourage Dutch athletes, because they'll be competing anyway. The sport is about uniting people. It's not about banning them.
I wonder if any of the runners among the Dutch themselves are thinking, well, this kind of, you know, undercuts our own authority as runners. If we do win, it's because we're not going against the people who usually do win.
Yes, that's right. And they also say it's bad for the prestige of the Utrecht Marathon. They don't like the measure. They like to compete against the big runners from Kenya. But, of course, they also see the advantage of having this measure imposed, because what the organisers say, and the Dutch runners feel the same way, they see the level of Dutch runners has gone down in recent years because Dutch runners have been demoralised because they can't win. They can't beat the Kenyans.
Of course, they could just give the Dutch a head start.
Yes, but that wouldn't be fair either, would it? But they're talking about an alternative. They say, well, why can't we have two marathons? One, an international event, which is billed as an international event, and one that's billed as a local event for Dutch runners only.
Okay, Theo Thomas, sports correspondent with Radio Netherlands Worldwide. Nice to talk to you.
Okay, nice to talk to you too. Thanks.
If Dutch runners are feeling a little bit like failures next to the Kenyans, well, that's not such a bad thing. A Dutch think tank is studying how failure can be a key stop on the road to success. The World's Clark Boyd has our story.
A boat ride through Amsterdam's canals is a testament to Holland's many successes. The Dutch beat back the sea with canals, dams, and dikes. They created a thriving city of trade and commerce and made a global name for themselves.
In the course of the centuries, Amsterdam has expanded into an international center of culture, trade, industry, and ocean and air travel.
And so it's a bit strange to find that Amsterdam is also home to the world's one and only Institute of Brilliant Failures.
If you look at the history of the Netherlands, it's very much a country of control and managing.
Paul Iske is the Institute's president. He says while the Dutch love that feeling of control, it's unrealistic in today's world.
And that gives a lot of people in the Netherlands a very nice feeling. We are in control. And the world is now very, very complex. Nobody can be in control. And it's now more a matter of navigation. And especially in this country, we need this change of thinking.
A few years back, Iske, a professor in business innovation, was doing research on business people in Holland who went through bankruptcy. He found that many were so traumatized and stigmatized that they never tried to start a business again. But those that did, Iske says, often succeeded because their failures had taught them something. Iska wanted to help others embrace failure, so he started the Institute and began offering failure workshops to businesses and organizations. There's also a website where anyone can nominate a brilliant failure in business, art, science, whatever. Of course, we're not talking about tripping over a shoelace kind of stuff. Brilliance in failing has to meet certain criteria, Iska says.
What we define as a brilliant failure is something that has been tried with very good intentions, and of course they experience something that is different than from what they try to achieve. That's the failure part. And the brilliant part is that we can learn something from it. Well, in the worst case scenario, the only thing you learn is that this was not the way to do it. And in the best case, you learn something totally different that you even didn't expect.
Iska's favorite example of this kind of serendipity is Viagra.
Don't let erectile dysfunction get in the way.
Viagra was originally developed as a heart medication, but it's the drug's side effects that have made it a winner. Another of Iska's favorite brilliant failures is homegrown. It involves Holland's beloved speed skating. You might remember that Dutch skater Sven Kramer was expected to win gold in the 10,000 meters in the Vancouver Winter Games last year. Kramer was well out in front, and then his coach mistakenly told him to change lanes at the wrong time, leading to a disqualification. Kramer relived the moment in this documentary on Dutch television.
Ik was bezig met de beste 10 kilometer van mijn leven.
At the end of the day, Kramer said, I'm responsible for the things I do. I find it difficult to accuse other people. So what turned a major blunder into a brilliant failure for Sven Kramer? His sportsmanlike way of dealing with defeat won him fans worldwide. Kramer's coach failed brilliantly as well. He now gives master classes to companies on dealing with disappointment. But is all this focus on failing a bit too, well, defeatist?
We are living in this interesting moment of what I've been sort of jokingly referring to as kind of a wrongness zeitgeist or a failure zeitgeist.
Catherine Schultz is author of Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. She says sharing failures is becoming increasingly popular. Engineers Without Borders in Canada, for example, has launched a website called Admitting Failure. Schultz says that's fine, as long as people really are learning from their mistakes.
I worry that it is easy to pay lip service to the sort of glory of wrongness. You know, yeah, we all make mistakes and things fail and they go awry and sort of talk that talk and yet not really grapple with the deep issue, which is, okay, so what are the emotional consequences of that? What are the material consequences, the financial consequences?
The Institute of Brilliant Failures, though, is urging people to dig deep. Again, Paul Iska.
People do not feel that freedom to experiment, the more or less the freedom that we have as children. When children fail, we all applaud and we say, okay, you learn something. And somehow we lose that tolerance when people grow up.
Iska says his research shows that the first step toward reclaiming that childlike freedom to fail is laughter. The next time you screw up, he says, you can start by laughing it off. For The World, this is Clark Boyd, Amsterdam.
You can check out a few more screw-ups, including, of course, a couple on video at our website. And we want to hear about your brilliant failures, too. Share them, at least the ones you don't mind telling us about, at theworld.org. News headlines from around the world are coming up next. This is PRI, Public Radio International. Lisa Mullins. Coming up, the head of NATO's Libya mission says defending civilians from Muammar Gaddafi's troops in Misrata is a challenge.
Gaddafi forces have taken their uniforms off, and they're shielding themselves with women and children. So when people ask me, why aren't you doing something, I'm not going to lower to his level. I'm not going to do the kind of warfare that he's doing.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, assembling the country's resuscitation experts to save more lives from sudden cardiac arrest. Learn more at heartrescueproject.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The Libyan city of Misrata has come to symbolize the struggle against Muammar Gaddafi's rule. Misrata is the rebels' main stronghold. It's in western Libya, and it's withstood a 7-week siege by pro-Gaddafi forces. But conditions in the city are becoming increasingly desperate, despite NATO airstrikes against Gaddafi's troops. And today, a White House spokesman said the U.S. has no plans to take a more active role in the conflict. Reporter Megan Williams spoke today in Naples, Italy, with the head of the NATO mission in Libya. His name is Lieutenant General Charles Bouchard. Megan, by all accounts, there is a mounting humanitarian crisis in Misrata with food and water and medical supplies all in very short supply. Did the Lieutenant General have an answer to those who are frustrated that NATO doesn't seem to be doing more to relieve that situation?
Well, the sense I got from General Bouchard is that he's just as frustrated as the people are. He's well aware that the situation is desperate in the city and that NATO really can't do a whole lot right now. Gaddafi's methods are such that he's protecting himself by civilians, and NATO is able to stop Gaddafi and his troops moving around outside of cities, but actually within the cities it's much more challenging. And here's what the general said about the situation right now there.
Inside the city, it's a very difficult, tough situation. Gaddafi forces have taken their uniforms off. They're hiding on rooftops of mosques, hospitals, schools. That's where their heavy equipment is positioned, near mosques, near school. And they're shielding themselves with women and children. So when people ask me, why aren't you doing something? Well, I'm not going to lower to his level. I'm not going to do the kind of warfare that he's doing. My job's to help the population.
So the question is then, how is NATO going to help the population? There's been talk of the eventual introduction of NATO ground troops. Does Lieutenant General Bouchard see this as a viable option?
No, right now, he said, it's not an option at all. I mean, NATO has been given a very narrow mandate, which is to protect civilians through the use of the Air Force. He said NATO is not going to be putting boots on the ground, nor does the NATO force in the area have the equipment to. I mean, they have ships and they have warplanes, but they're not set up to go in, even to protect humanitarian efforts. So right now the challenge, obviously, is that they have to be extremely careful about killing civilians when they drop bombs. So he said they're focusing on other sorts of targets.
We're after his lines of communication. We're after his ammo depot. We're after his command and control system. We continue to hit tanks where we can and not cause any more damage than his forces are doing. Just, in fact, I'd say less than 2 hours ago, two more tanks were destroyed in the Misrata area. So we continue all the time to put pressure on him.
All right. Well, Megan, right now there seems to be a bit of a stalemate between Gaddafi troops and NATO. Neither side seems to be making any headway. Did the Lieutenant General have any thoughts on which side might gain the most from continuing a stalemate?
Some analysts think that the stalemate could give the rebels the advantage because it will give them time to train and equip. The problem on the ground is that there's a lot of chaos. I mean, these are untrained men. So if in some way they bought a bit more time, they might be able to face off against Gaddafi's troops more effectively. But others worry that the longer that this goes on, the less interest the NATO countries will have in protecting the civilians. Divisions could emerge within NATO. Bickering could take place. But General Bouchard says the main military concern right now is that Gaddafi will use the standoff to reload.
Our job is to stop him from hitting the civilian population. But what I want to make sure is these stops do not become a temporary moment for the Gaddafi regime to reload their weapons. And that, I'm working on that. It's a knife fight in a phone booth, and it's very difficult to get in the middle of that. But sometimes you're better off just to make sure that nobody else gets inside that and to make sure that we stop the reinforcements.
All right. That, once again, is Lieutenant General Charles Bouchard, who is the head of the NATO mission in Libya. And he spoke to you, Megan Williams, from Naples, Italy. Thank you very much for talking about your interview with him.
Thank you, Lisa.
The Libyan uprising was inspired by revolutions in neighboring Egypt and Tunisia. In fact, Tunisians sparked the Arab Spring when they ousted their ruler back in January. But many have fled their country since. A fishing town called Zarzis has been ground zero for the mass immigration. thousands of people have left Zarzis for Europe, many of them with the help of smugglers. And those smugglers do what it takes to secure boats to transport the immigrants. That's left fishermen in Zarzis without a means to make a living, Marine Alavisi reports.
Five fishermen sit killing time in the shade of a palm tree. On a regular day, they'd be sailing right now. Each would bring home about $15 worth of fish and 2 pounds of fresh calamari for a spaghetti dinner. Instead, they're arguing over what happened to Mabruka, the white boat with a sky blue stripe. Farhad asks his cousin and the boat's owner, Mohamed, why did you leave Mabruka in the water? Mohamed says, where else could I have put it? In my bedroom? Mohamed swears he kept a close eye on Mabruka, just not close enough, it turns out. Mohamed says, I stayed till midnight guarding the boat. Then at 3 a.m., I came back to check on it. All I found were fishing nets floating around, but the boat was gone. They've stolen many boats that way. For Tarzi smugglers, boats like Mabruka are a disposable yet essential commodity. Many of the 25,000 Europe-bound migrants who've left in the past 3 months have gone in a Tarzi's fishing boat. Italian authorities confiscate the boats once they arrive in Lampedusa. Mohammed's boat was worth about $13,000. He says he was offered more than twice that amount, but he refused to sell three times. Mohamed says the boat was his grandfather's, then his father's. He says Mabruka fed his family for 2 decades. He couldn't possibly sell it. Now, he says he should have. Mohamed's wife and 2 kids have moved back with his in-laws because money is tight without the boat. Mohamed is also missing out on the most lucrative period for fishing in Zarzis, the shrimp season, which just started. It's unclear how many other fishermen have been hurt by the spike in smuggling. The regional marine authority reports about 30 boats from Zarzis are now in Italy, but fishermen here say that's a gross understatement. Some estimate that up to 200 boats, over half of the town's fleet, have been sold or stolen. One of the men who's been trading in boats is Mario. He owns a car rental company, but he says that lately, the boat business is an easier way to make money.
Right now, you can buy a boat without leaving a single record of the transaction. You give the fisherman money, he gives you his boat. The buyer doesn't need any document. The boat's here for a one-way ride and to make some money out of it.
Later, Mario admits he's made loads of money doing this. It's illegal to buy boats without a fishing license, but Mario says in 2 days Tunisia, there are laws, but no law enforcement. That's true, says Bouzid Slah with the Regional Marine Authority's fishing division. He says they've identified about 20 boat traffickers in Zarzis alone, but no one's going after them. He says right now, everybody is skirting the law in one way or another. We're keeping tabs, but there's nothing else we can do for now. He says it's hard to know how boat trafficking will affect the fishing economy here in the long run. For now, though, it's a boon for those who still have their boats. They're getting a much higher price for shrimp this year. Beyond the price of fish, though, some say the town's identity might take a big hit. 23-year-old Karim says fishing here is still a craft and a lifestyle passed down from father to son. Karim points to a small blue and red boat pitching and tossing on the waves about 100 feet away. It's too windy to go out, yet he can count on one hand the boats moored near his own. Karim says the recent exodus isn't just about boats. Many young fishermen have gone, too. About 20 of his friends are now on the other side of the Mediterranean. He says, my neighborhood used to be full of people I hung out with. We used to go to the cafe and chill together in the evening. Now there's only 4 of us left. Karim says that's why he hasn't sold his small wooden craft. With most of his fishing buddies gone, his family and this boat are all he's got now. For The World, I'm Marine Olivesi in Zarzis, Tunisia.
From trafficking boats, we move to a story now about trafficking drugs on boats. But these boats aren't like any you've ever seen. They're closer to submarines, really, but decidedly low-tech. Authorities in Colombia recently captured one, and as John Otis reports, they describe it as a homemade narco-submarine.
You can see the evolution of maritime drug smuggling here at Colombia's main naval base at Bahia Malaga on the Pacific coast. The main pier is packed with captured fishing trawlers and high-speed cigarette boats once favored by traffickers. There's also a handful of enclosed vessels with pipes and snorkels sticking out at odd angles. But don't let the Dr. Seuss design fool you. Captain Norberto Benavides tells me these so-called semi-submersibles were built to transport tons of cocaine. These were semi-submersibles that didn't make it through, he says. They were detected. Semi-submersibles are sealed boats that travel just below the ocean's surface. They leave tiny wakes and are extremely difficult to spot. They're also low cost. Still, U.S. and Colombian authorities have gotten better at tracking semi-subs, and that's led to the latest innovation in cocaine smuggling. Last year, for the first time, authorities captured a fully submersible submarine built by drug traffickers in Ecuador, just south of the Colombian border. Then, in February, Colombian authorities discovered a second drug sub under construction. Now, it's docked at the naval base here in Bahia Malaga. In the submarine's stern, Navy Lieutenant Fernando Monroy points to a powerful diesel engine and tanks that can hold 1,700 gallons of fuel. The sub also carries compressed air tanks, bunk beds, a GPS, and a night vision camera.
Por debajo va droga.
Lieutenant Monroy also shows me a storage compartment in the bow with space for 8 tons of cocaine. He fears that drug submarines are here to stay.
We believe the smugglers will keep improving the technology, allowing them to make all their trips underwater.
Colombian officials believe the sub cost around $4 million. Yet it's hardly state-of-the-art. The 70-foot-long body has been fashioned from supplies you could buy at Home Depot: fiberglass, wood, and PVC tubing. It's also small, about the same size as a semi-sub. Once packed with cocaine, fuel, and food, there wouldn't be much room left for the 4 crew members.
El primer viaje mío fue en el 98.
This Colombian fishing boat captain says he made 3 trips to Mexico at the helm of drug-laden semi-subs. He earned $300,000 per trip, but describes living conditions during those 2-week voyages as hellish.
Son dantescos. ¿No le parece? Son dantescos.
There was no toilet, he says. Vapors from excrement, cocaine, and diesel made it difficult to eat, sleep, and breathe.
Nunca se puede salir porque no se puede parar.
The captain, who asked not to be identified, says they rarely stopped because it's harder to detect moving vessels.
Without question, it has us all going back to the textbooks and the drawing boards and figuring out what are we going to do about this.
Jay Bergman heads the DEA's Andean Division. He points out that, so far, no drug submarines have been detected under the sea. But seizures of semi-submersibles have dropped dramatically in the past 2 years.
For the analyst looking at emerging threats, when they see this precipitous drop in semi-submersibles and then the advent of these 2 submarines, there's concern that's raised. What are we missing?
U.S. and Colombian officials vow to make the necessary adjustments to target submarines. Meanwhile, there's no shortage of people willing to risk their lives aboard the drug subs. Many cocaine traffickers are based in the Pacific port of Buenaventura. Poverty and unemployment here are high, so fishermen sometimes agree to work as maritime smugglers, like the semi-sub captain who made 3 runs to Mexico.
El último me ofrecieron $500,000.
He says he was recently offered $500,000 to make another trip to Mexico, but he turned down the offer.
Dos viajes le dicho muchas gracias, no quiero.
I told them, thank you very much. I wish you all the luck in the world, but I'm not interested. For The World, I'm John Otis, Buenaventura, Colombia.
As John said, these aren't state-of-the-art submarines. By the look of them, you think they'd sink like stone, but they don't. You can check out a slideshow at theworld.org. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights took shape after World War II, and the United Nations adopted it in Paris in 1948. Today, for our GeoQuiz, we're looking for what's thought to be one of the earliest human rights charters. It's called the Cyrus Cylinder. It's actually an ancient Persian clay object. The words written on the back of it in the 6th century BC pay tribute to the Persian king Cyrus the Great. The thing was excavated from the ruins of Babylon and Mesopotamia, which is now known as Iraq. And the clay fragments are now part of the British Museum's Persian collection. But for the past half year, the Cyrus Cylinder's been on loan to another country's national museum. Huge crowds have come in to see the exhibit in this country. Here's a hint, used to go by the name of Persia. So can you name this country or its national museum? The answer's on the way. Tomorrow, butts out in Bhutan, or else the tough tobacco ban in Bhutan. Coming up tomorrow on The World on PRI. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Just ahead, we're going to check out a Latin band with a gypsy ska flavor. First, though, let's answer our geo-quiz today. Iran and its National Museum in Tehran are the answers we're looking for today. That's where the crowds have been flocking to see an exhibit about ancient Persia. The BBC's John Wilson reports from Tehran.
The Iranian National Museum in Tehran. A large group of people gather round a glass case which stands at the center of this gallery. It contains a small cylindrical clay artifact. It was inscribed in 539 BC on the orders of the Persian king Cyrus, Cyrus the Great. This object records how he liberated the city of Babylon from tyranny, how he freed and repatriated enslaved people, and how he decreed that all the people of Babylon should be allowed to practice their own religion and culture. The Cyrus Cylinder is regarded by some historians as the world's first ever human rights charter. It's been here in Tehran for the last 7 months on loan from the British Museum. This is the last day of the exhibition. So what does the Cyrus Cylinder mean to the people who have come to see it?
This is one of the most valuable documents in the world and can lead us to live freely in the world and show us how to live.
I feel they're coming alive. They look like a 3D TV to me.
It's like looking at a 3D TV.
Yes. I just enjoy and be happy. My heart starts beating so fast. Iran was the center of the world so many years ago, but nowadays we're left apart. In the schools and universities, they don't talk about these things to us.
Because it's part of the pre-Islamic history.
Yeah.
It's a piece of a puzzle. A puzzle of peace, happiness, and
freedom.
Freedom, yes. It's a hope. I can imagine that world, and it's very powerful.
What does it represent to you?
For human rights.
The Cyrus exhibition has been a revelation to many people in Iran. But how would the British Museum director Neil McGregor measure the success of the loan?
What is, I think, particularly significant is that it was this object that the Iranians wanted to borrow, that the Islamic Republic of Iran should choose to borrow a pre-Islamic object, and that it should have this enormous resonance with the public.
In effect, you are the sole conduit of dialogue between Britain and Iran at the moment. Does that make you feel uncomfortable at all?
What I think this exhibition creates is a space in which other conversations can take place. We know that in Tehran, around it, have been many debates about human rights, about justice. The exhibition itself doesn't address these big issues of the relationship. What it does do is create a space in which difficult conversations can take place.
There are many Iranians, opponents of the regime, who are unhappy that the British Museum agreed to this loan of the Cyrus cylinder. They say it's only here to make President Ahmadinejad look good, to make him appeal to the middle classes, make him seem more sympathetic to the pre-Islamic heritage that the mullahs tried to deny. But it's clear from the people that I've spoken to here in Tehran, particularly the well-dressed, articulate young people, that the Cyrus cylinder represents to them not only a proud nationalistic heritage, but also a symbol of hope and possible freedom for a future Iran.
That's the BBC's John Wilson. If you'd like to read what's written on the Cyrus cylinder in English or in Persian, we've posted links at theworld.org. Finally today, the group La Santa Cecilia takes its name from the patron saint of musicians. But as Beto Arcos reports, they don't play what you'd think of as religious music.
La Santa Cecilia's sound is a hybrid mix of music reflecting the city where they live and play, Los Angeles. Their Latin flavor songs can combine a funky ska beat with a gypsy flavor guitar riff. Take a listen to this song, Vengo. Guitarist Gloria Estrada says when the band started playing 4 years ago, she noticed their music brought together their diverse backgrounds.
I think all six members have such different influences, and we are all, I think, really open to everything. So I think it was a nice blend, and it was refreshing, I think, for everybody to kind of be able to experiment freely with our music.
The musicians that make up La Santa Cecilia are children of immigrants. Three were born in Los Angeles, two in Mexico, and one in Venezuela. La Marisol is the lead singer and the band's main songwriter.
I had a dream last night. So many colors, so much light. A long staircase whose magic to the sky. I had a dream last night.
La Marisol grew up singing boleros and Mexican rancheras with musicians who play on L.A.'s historic Olvera Street.
So my base and what I know from music and is from there, from what I learned with the musicians there. And that's where I grew up, that's where I'm from. And La Santa Cecilia is like the vehicle for me to express and explore and grow. And I'm happy for that. I'm happy that I found them.
Cuando la negra te invite a bailar, no le digas no.
La Santa Cecilia began at a drunken party as a fun experiment. Today, they're one of LA's most successful Latin bands, and they're redefining a hip Latin sound of Los Angeles. For the past year, they've been on a nonstop tour, playing gigs up and down California and recently in Texas, where they showcased at Austin South by Southwest. They put out two EPs, and a few months ago, they were signed to a label founded by a multiple Grammy Award winner producer. Guitarist Gloria Estrada says it's a new opportunity.
Got to work with a producer this time and got to have a nice sounding album as opposed to our first EP. But I mean, you know, It's a work in progress, I think, for everybody.
Lead singer La Marisol says they're working on a single due out this month.
For this April release, and I'm really excited, you know, because we're really working on like the artwork and the concept of how we're going to release this.
She says they've been keeping this secret from their fans. It's a new version of one of their most popular songs, Chicle, or Gum. Their plan is to release it as a single in a specially designed little package that will include a code to download it and a treat to chew on. For The World, I'm Beto Arcos in Los Angeles.
You can check out the music video for La Santa Cecilia's song La Negra and follow what the band is up to on Twitter at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide, plowshares.org. The National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin. More information online at nsf.gov. The Freeman Foundation. And by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. Information at macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.